Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, a board member of the Center for Investigative Reporting and a longtime journalist. I'll be your moderator for today's program called Harpoon, Combating Terrorism. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Nitzana Darshan Leitner. She's the founder of the nonprofit Sherat Hardin, which is an Israeli law center which has represented hundreds of victims of bombing, shootings, and other atrocities in Israel perpetrated by groups like Hamas, the PLO, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Hezbollah, and probably others. I think we're in for a treat this evening, and would you please welcome Nitzana Darshan Leitner.
Thank you. Hi, good evening. My name is Nitzana Darshan Leitner. I'm the president of Sherat Hardin, Israel Law Center, a non-for-profit based in Tel Aviv that fights terror financing. I recently came out with a book, Harpoon, which describes the financial warfare of the state of Israel against the terrorists. And I will speak a little bit about how we wind up writing this book. It was 1996. It was 3 years into the Oslo Accords, and we Israelis were promised peace. We were promised that this agreement will bring a halt to the terrorism, that the PLO will halt all terror attacks, that Yasser Arafat will become Baal Tshuva. And instead, we got bloodshed, suicide bombing, drive-by shooting, ambushes, people getting killed on a daily basis. And there was no end in sight. The master spy, the legendary former head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan, was back then, in 1996, the counterterrorism advisor for the prime minister. And he was looking for ways to stop this terrorism, but in a non-conventional way. Because he saw a dilemma. He saw when Israel cares about its soldiers' life and is fearful for each victim that gets killed on the street, the other side does not care about its own people's life. They are pushing their people to carry out attacks, to carry out suicide bombings, to blow themselves up on the street. So he was looking for ways to get this asymmetrical lawfare bridge. And he realized that if he wants to dismantle the terrorists without risking IDF soldiers' life, he has to go after their financial infrastructure. Because he saw something that others did not see. He didn't see just the one who was wearing explosive vests and blows himself up. He did not see that the one who was holding a knife and stabbing people on the street. He did not see just the one who was carrying a machine gun and shooting towards all the people in the crowd. He saw an industry. He saw terrorists teaming up, backed by tens of millions of dollars that allowing them to keep going forward. Money that was coming from Iran, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, from local Muslim communities in United States, in Europe, winding up in the hands of the terrorists, allowing them to kill innocent civilians. And he realized that if he wants to stop this flow of terrorism, he has to stop the flow of their money. So he went to back then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and asked him to form a task force that its only goal will be to combat terror funding. It will include representatives of the Mossad, of the Shin Bet, of the military, of the treasury, of the defense ministry, but will have one goal: to go after the funds of the terrorists. Netanyahu agreed, and they established Harpoon. Harpoon, the name of the book, was until now the secret unit in the Mossad that tracked terror funding with only one mission. Follow the money, target the money, kill the money. Money was the oxygen to terrorism, and they were determined to choke it off. It wasn't easy for Harpoon to take all these operations. Nobody listened to Meir Dagan. They thought it was crazy when people are getting killed on the street to go and fight the money. Until 2002. In 2002, Meir Dagan was elevated to become the head of the Mossad by his best friend, former mentor and commander, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. 2002 was the peak of the Intifada. The Dolphin Iron discotheque in Tel Aviv, 28 teenagers get killed. Moment Cafe in Jerusalem, 18 young people over coffee getting killed. Park Hotel in Netanya, 30 guests over Passover Seder getting massacred. So Ariel Sharon called Meir Dagan to seek for ways to stop this terrorism. Now, the one who's in charge in Israel for the interior security affairs is the Shin Bet, the General Security Services. But yet, Ariel Sharon called Meir Dagan because he knew that if he needs to look for new waves, for innovative, creative waves, it will be Meir Dagan that will come up with him. He was looking for a pirate between his teeth, and he knew that Meir Dagan can accomplish the mission. He knew Meir Dagan's story. Meir Dagan was born in 1945 on a train when his parents tried to escape from Ukraine to Russia. They were living in Siberia for 5 years, and then they made Aliyah to Israel. Meir Dagan was 5 years old when he came to Israel, and he immediately wanted to be an Israeli. He wanted to become a Sabra, but he wasn't able to. He didn't know Hebrew. The little he knew, he spoke with a very heavy accent. But yet, he wanted to succeed. When he became 18 and was drafted to the military, he wanted to join the best elite unit of the IDF at the time, Sayeret Matkal. Sayeret Matkal was the one who invaded Entebbe, the one that Yoni Netanyahu got killed, that Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, our former prime ministers or current prime ministers served. But again, he wasn't able to. At the time, the kids of the families that were drafted to Sayeret Matkal were the one of the families of the establishment, of the kibbutzim, of those who build the country. Meir Dagan was not born to the right family with the right connections or the right accent. So he was drafted to the paratroops. And yet, he wanted to be a winner. So when he was assigned with his first mission to go to Gaza and dismantle the terrorists over there, he did it in the most creative way. Ariel Sharon was a Southern commander at the time. He sent Meir Dagan and gave him the mission to destroy the terrorist organizations. When Meir Dagan came to Gaza, there were 850 wanted terrorists. When he left, there were only 9 remain. And he did it with the most creative way. One day, for instance, he dressed up as a Palestinian, took his colleagues dressed up as Palestinians as well, and took a boat, arrived at the shore of Gaza, demanding to meet with the local commander of the terror cell in Gaza. The terror commander came to him, and he told him that he came all the way from South Lebanon. He is the commander of the same terror cell from South Lebanon. He came to Gaza because the rumor was spread that the local commander collaborates with Israel, that he came to put him on trial, and if he finds him guilty, he will execute him. The local commander was shivering, was afraid, was telling Meir Dagan all the names of his co-commanders, his terrorists, his soldiers. He urged Meir Dagan to go and ask these people if he ever collaborated with Israel, if he ever was an ally of Israel. He gave Meir Dagan all their names, their addresses, their phone numbers, where are in day, where are in night. You can imagine that by the end of the week, all these people got arrested. So Ariel Sharon asked Mayor Dagan how they're going to stop this wave of terrorism. And Mayor Dagan told him his theory, the one that was ignored until now, that the new battlefield is to go after the terror funding. He told him that there are two sources coming into the hands of the terror organizations in the West Bank and Gaza. One was Yasser Arafat. When the Palestinian Authority got established, both the United States and the European Union committed to pay the Palestinian Authority and provide them with financial aid to help them to get established. They paid them hundreds of millions of dollars. But Yasser Arafat was taking the money, putting it in his own personal pockets, or diverting to terrorism. So Mayor Dagan told Ariel Sharon that they have to separate Yasser Arafat from his money. And Ariel Sharon, who wasn't fond of Yasser Arafat, never shook his hand, agreed, and asked Mayor Dagan how exactly they're going to do it. And Mayor Dagan told him there are two ways to accomplish a mission. One above the table, the other one underneath the table. The one above the table is the right and the proper one. The one underneath the table is the one that will get the job done. He told him, let's use Harpoon. So they sent Harpoon unit agents to a country in South America, and over there they established an investment fund. They rented fancy offices in the most exclusive part of the town. They rented fancy furnitures. They hired beautiful young secretaries and opened an investment fund. And then they called Mohammed Rashid, who was the financial advisor of Yasser Arafat, to come to this Latin America country and learn about this investment fund. Mohammed Rashid came, and he was shown what high interest he can get if he invests with a fund, what lucrative return he will get, what a kickback, personal benefits he himself will get if he invests with a company. Mohammed Rashid, who usually was very cautious, left all caution behind and started investing with a fund. And indeed, in a couple of months, he got return, lucrative return, high interest as high as 30%, personal benefits. He did not pull the money out. He kept investing more and more of Yasser Arafat's money with the company. And then one day, Mohammed Rashid made a random call to the company and nobody answered the phone. He called the next day. He thought maybe they were closed for the day and nobody answered the phone. The third day he came, he took a plane and went to the Latin America country to look for the offices. The offices were gone, along with hundreds of millions of dollars of Arafat's money. In the book, I tell a lot of stories of these operations, going on to bombing banks from the air that held bank accounts for designated terror organizations, surrounding banks and marching in, demanding the money to be given to them in cash, money that belongs to the terror organizations, and continue with assassinations, the one that Mossad is most famous for, but not assassination of the terrorist, but the money men. Mayor Dagan made it very clear that if you are involved with a terror organization, and even if you are only the money man, and perhaps because you are the money man, you became a target, perhaps the highest valued target of them all. Because from now on, he said, there will be no more white job collars in a terror organization. We had a front row seat watching these operations of Harpoon and taking part of some of them. Shirat Adin was established in 2002 in the peak of the Intifada. After we filed lawsuits as private lawyers against Iran, against Syria, against terror organizations, against the Palestinian Authority, going after their funds. We realized that as lawyers, perhaps we can take a role in the war against terrorism by doing what lawyers do best, go after the pocketbooks of the terror organizations. And after 2 years, we won decisions in our favor. We got called from more and more Torah victims that wanted us to represent them in court. And we got approached by Mayor Dagan and his Harpoon agents to see if they can collaborate with us. Because Mayor Dagan realized that all this information that they gathered in their secret operations against the banks have a value, a very high value. And he didn't want it to get to waste. So he asked, if he gives us this information, can we go after these banks? Can we sue these financial institutions that allow the money to come into the West Bank and Gaza? And we agreed. We started filing lawsuits against Arab banks, European banks, Canadian banks, Lebanese banks, Chinese banks. Some of the cases have settled out of courts. Some of them are still litigated in the courts in the United States. The impact of these cases is extraordinary. And they are twofold. One, it gives money to the terror victims. Ella Boukassis was only 17 years old when she was walking one day with her brother, 15 years old, coming from a youth movement in Sderot, when the red alert went off. This is the alarm that goes on when the missiles are falling from Gaza. In Tel Aviv, you have 90 seconds to find a shelter. In Ashdod, which is a little bit southern than Tel Aviv, you have 60 seconds to find a shelter. In Sderot, which is right on the border of Gaza, you have 15 seconds to find a shelter. So she was walking down the street. It was a bare street. There was no building, no bus stop to hide underneath them. So the only thing that went into her mind is to protect her brother. She fell over her brother. She covered him. The missile fell right near their heads. Many sharp nails went into their both heads. She fought for 7 days on her life in the hospital. She died. Her brother is disabled for life. We are asked if we can file a lawsuit against a major bank that provided financial services to Hamas at the time. We filed a lawsuit along with 150 terror victims from Hamas and the family of Ella Boukassis as well. And we recently won. So father of Ella Boukassis called me up. He said, thank you for letting me fight back. Thank you for returning my dignity back. I feel I'm no longer a victim. And this is what these cases do. They enable the victims to fight back. No money can bring back life. But money gives a measure of closure, a measure of justice to the terror victims. The other fall of these cases is the shockwave that they sent through the international banking system, that not only the banks that were sued shut down immediately all the bank accounts that had for terror organizations, but no bank in the Arab, in the Western world agreed anymore to open bank account to a designated terror organization. No bank agreed to provide financial services to Islamic charity without making sure that they are not identified with a terror organization. And no bank agreed to operate anymore in terror zones like South Lebanon, like Gaza. There is no banking system in Gaza anymore. This is why we see them smuggling money into Gaza in cash, in suitcases. It used to be through the tunnels. Today, it's through money changers. But that caused Hamas a great deal of harm because they need to bring hundreds of millions of dollars into the Gaza Strip. They run a government. In order to continue operating among civilians, to use the population in Gaza as human shields, to send children, women, old men to the fence, to infiltrate into Israel, to risk their life, they have to pay the population money and to provide them with all services they need from cradle to grave. That costs a lot of money. Hamas is a military. They have tens of thousands of soldiers. Sometimes they wear uniforms. Most of the time they don't, but they always get paid on a monthly basis. Hamas supports its prisoners who are sitting in the Israeli jail. They get a salary that ranges between $500 to $3,000 per month. Depends on the sentence they got, which depends on the number of Israelis they killed. Just to compare, the average salary in Gaza is only $300. And Hamas keeps building these underground tunnels, keep bringing missiles into the Gaza Strip. To maintain all this infrastructure, Hamas budget stands today on $500 million. You need a bank to bring this money into the Gaza Strip. Without the bank, you are in very deep financial problems. And every time there is a bank that does not care and is willing to take the risk and provide Hamas with financial services, we go, we gather victims of Hamas and bring a lawsuit against this bank in the courts in the United States. We also have cases against state-sponsored terrorism, against Iran, against Syria, against North Korea for helping and providing material support to terror organizations in the Middle East, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, like Islamic Jihad. We win judgments against these countries, and we enforce them against assets that belong to these countries. We went after bank accounts that belong to Iran, frozen in the United States. Indeed, in the beginning, the State Department did not want us to collect the judgment against these assets. We hired a lobbyist. We changed the law in the Congress, which overcame the objections of the State Department. We were able to seize the money in the account, give it to the terror victims. We found real estate, buildings in Queens, New York, a skyscraper in Manhattan called 655 Fifth Avenue, all owned by Iranian government, waiting to be sold. The proceeds will go to the terror victims. We found the house of the son of the Shah. Years ago, when the son of the Shah wanted to become a pilot, his father sent him to Lubbock, Texas, where they have a big Air Force base, and bought him a house. After the Islamic Revolution, the house became a property of the Islamic government. We learned about the house. We went to the sheriff in Lubbock, Texas, gave him our judgment, and asked him to force a sale on the house. The sheriff sold the house and gave us the money to the terror victims. And just last year, we put a lien on the deal that Iran signed with Boeing to purchase 80 aircraft for $17 billion. We went to the court in Chicago, where Boeing has its headquarters. We filed a lien. We said, we have a judgment against Iran. We are entitled to the Iranian money that will go in this deal or to the aircrafts. Boeing came to court. They said that if we continue and eventually impose a lien on the deal, Iran will cancel the deal. And this will obstruct the nuclear agreement with Iran, because one of the components of the nuclear agreement was that Iran will be able to purchase American manufacturers' airplanes. So the court went to the State Department and asked them for their position. And the State Department came to court just recently, said that they recognize the rights of the victims to enforce their judgment, and they are not going to intervene with the case. They will let the victims to pursue justice. The case is going forward in the courts in Chicago. I will stop here and we'll open it for questions. But in addition to all these cases, we have cases against the Palestinian Authority, against the PLO, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. Recently, we went after the social media networks, cases against Facebook, Twitter, Google, and there is no end in sight. We are able to win judgments for $2 billion. We are able to put a lien on $600 million in terror assets. And we actually collected more than $300 million that went to the terror victims. This is the financial war against terrorism. The State of Israel is doing what they're doing. Harpoon was doing what it's doing. Surat Adin is fighting in the legal theater. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Nitzana Darshan-Leitner, the president of Shirat Hadin, an Israeli nonprofit that works to protect the rights of victims of terror. So one question, and I enjoyed your book, and there was a lot in it, and some of it, or much of it, is about financial issues and the tracking of money and incredible, I guess, almost movie-like scripts, mysteries, things that Israeli intelligence community, Shin Bet and Mossad, and maybe you were involved in, as well as, going after and killing targeted assassinations of the men who were involved in the money. But how successful is the delivery of money? One of the sections of the book deals with the June summer war of 2006 with Lebanon, and you lay out what happened. And there was, a finding that both North Korea, and it was interesting, you went after North Korea and Iran for supplying Hezbollah with the missiles that were raining down on Israel.
Right.
And a judgment was made, but is the money, can you describe, is there any of that money actually going to any of the victims, or is it still all tied up in international issues?
Okay, so these were a bunch of cases that we filed following the second Lebanese war in Israel in 2006. And what happened was that the security forces in Israel and Harpoon realized that Hezbollah is receiving its money from Iran through Lebanese banks. The major bank over there was Lebanese Canadian Bank. And they did not have so much leverage against this bank because it's based in Lebanon. They cannot come and carry out operations as they did against banks in the West Bank and Gaza. It's in a foreign country. So they ask the help of the United States to try to block the bank accounts of Hezbollah and to send a message to the Lebanese Canadian Bank and perhaps even to terminate oil relationship that United States banking system had with Lebanese Canadian Bank. Because in the end of the day, the money was going from Iran to Hezbollah in dollars. And a dollar transaction must go through a correspondent American bank, which is located in the United States. So they helped the U.S. administration to help with these transactions. United States was afraid. They were afraid that if they terminate any relationship with them, they will have to, they will make collapse the Lebanese Canadian Bank, which is a major bank in Lebanon. And they refused to collaborate. So Harpoon asked us if we can file a lawsuit against Lebanese Canadian Bank. We gathered victims from the Second Lebanese War, which had American citizens, and even without American citizens, Druze, Muslims, Arabs, Jews, Christians, everybody who got killed or hit with the missile attacks in the Lebanese war, and finally lost against Lebanese Canadian Bank in the United States, along with its correspondent American bank, which was American Express Bank. And to make a long story short, both banks came to court, filed a motion to dismiss, said that they didn't know that the money was going to the hands of Hezbollah, because it wasn't under bank account with the name of Hezbollah. It was under different names like User Foundation, Martyr Foundation. And also they said, Lebanese Canadian Bank said that there is no personal jurisdiction in the United States because Lebanese Canadian Bank is a Canadian bank or is a Lebanese bank. It has no offices or business in the United States. And the court did two things. First, it dismissed the lawsuit against American Express Bank because he accepted the allegation that they didn't know. No matter that the name of the bank account was Martyr Foundation, it still passed it somehow. But against Lebanese Canadian Bank, he said because the transactions were done in dollars, and then money that wind up in the hands of Hezbollah was going through the correspondent American bank in the United States, the long-arm status of the United States gets the bank under the jurisdiction of the United States, and the case can go forward against them in the U.S. So this case continues to go on. Other cases we filed in the course of this war was against North Korea, because we learned that North Korea, that usually does not export many things, as a matter of fact, they don't export anything, have one specialty. They know how to build bunkers. They know how to build underground tunnels. And they help Hezbollah to build their underground tunnels, what Hezbollah utilized in the Second Lebanese War, to shoot missiles towards Israel and to kill innocent people. So we filed a lawsuit against North Korea on behalf of victims of the Second Lebanese War, and we won a judgment against them for $332 million.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Now, we're asking if the victims saw this money. I can tell you, not yet. We are looking for assets that belong to North Korea. Just recently, we detected a boat that North Korea tried to smuggle weapon from Cuba with. They loaded the weapon on the boat. They covered it with bags of sugar. But the boat went on a reef on the Mexico Gulf, and Mexican government blocked the boat. So we hired a lawyer in Mexico City, went to put a lien on the boat. When the lawyer came and checked the boat, he told us, listen, I don't think you should go after this boat. It's such an old boat. By the time you finish this legal proceeding, you'll have to pay more money to the Mexican government for keeping this boat. We asked him if he can go after the weapon. He said, no, they're not going to give you the weapon. We asked, what about the sugar? He said, the sugar is so low quality that you don't want the sugar.
Well, reading the book again, a lot of what you do almost sounds like spy work or espionage, and a lot of the book reads like a spy thriller. But I'm curious, Harpoon, I'm not sure it really exists with the death of Meyer Duggan. And so did you have to go through a lot of hoops to get this published, because you lay out a lot of details, or is most of it public record? Or how much were you actually censored or go through Israeli censorship?
Right. So we definitely had to go through censorship in Israel. When I first approached the censor, which is a general in the IDF, she is a woman, was very, very in favor of publishing this book. She told us immediately that she loves Shurat Adin. She loves the work that we do. She thinks it's crucial, it's important. She wants the story to go out. But she has to ask the permission of the Mossad, of the Shin Bet, to publish this book. And they didn't want the book, the stories in the book, to go out one after another, not because they were afraid to reveal secrets. Obviously, if there are security issues, the book would not be published. But they wanted to keep it to themselves. And she insisted. She said, no, it's a pro-Israeli book. It's an important book because it teaches the other nations how to fight terror financing. There is a huge advantage by publishing the book. And she fought on our behalf against the Mossad to get it out. Having said all that, she censored large parts of the book. But she let some of the stories to go out.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the interesting things you really lay out is not simply a system of buying weapons and smuggling them in and they're used, but also the whole infrastructure of financial support, and you sort of alluded to it in your talk. But what happens to the families of suicide bombers, and how important is that to maintaining that kind of strategy?
So Look, going after, we first of all, don't go after the families of the suicide bombers, or we don't go after the families of the terrorists. We don't really see the point of doing it. These people don't care about their life, not least about money. What we're trying to do is to go after the deep pocket, is to go after the organization that sent them and those who financially support them. And indeed, we are targeting all our work against these endeavors. If you, one of the things that, if we were talking about the support of the families of the suicide bombers, we used it as one of our evidence in the court. I can tell you that we had a case against the PLO and the PA that we filed many years ago in 2004 on behalf of 10 families that lost their loved ones in the most heinous terror attacks during the Intifada. I talk about this case in the book. Suicide bombing in Hebrew University cafeteria. 7 students get killed. 443 Road attacks, bus number 19. And the reason we filed this lawsuit is to get a federal court judgment declaring who's responsible for the Intifada. Because when Israel was yelling and saying that Arafat's directed Intifada, nobody would listen. So he wanted to get such a judgment. We filed a lawsuit in the federal court. And the Palestinian Authority and the PA hired a lawyer. They went to court. They filed a motion to dismiss. Won't go into the details right now. But eventually it went to trial after 11 years of litigation. The trial opened in 2015 in New York. It was a jury trial. And the main defense of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO was that all these attacks indeed were done by employees of the Palestinian Authority. We proved, and they accepted it, that the attacks were done by Palestinian policemen, Palestinian security guards, officials of the PLO, all under the authority of the Palestinian Authority, all under the direction of Yasser Arafat. But they said that although they were employees, they were rogue employees. They did the attacks after work hours. They weren't authorized to kill Israelis. It wasn't their policy to kill Jews. But when the trial opened, they found it hard to explain to the jury. If they were rogue employees, how do you keep paying their salary until today? Those terrorists who were engaged in the terror attacks that were put on trial in the Israeli court and served their sentence in the Israeli jail keep receiving their salary month after month. You pay compensation to their families. You promote them in rank every 3 years. You pay stipends to the families of the suicide bombers. You call town squares and soccer games on the name of the terrorists. This is not how you treat rogue employees. This is not where your policy is against killing Jews. So there was no surprise when the jury came back. They found the PA and the PLO responsible for all 24 acts of terrorism and gave us a judgment against them for $655 million. Unfortunately, just to end the story, this judgment was vacated in the Supreme Court. The Palestinian Authority filed an appeal on this judgment. But they didn't challenge the jury verdict. They didn't challenge the evidence in the case. They didn't challenge the expert reports in the case or the victim's testimonies. They challenged one technical issue, personal jurisdiction. They came and said the Palestinian Authority is not acting in the United States. They don't have business in the United States. They don't have office in the United States. There is no personal jurisdiction. You can't bring Palestinian Authority into the court in the United States and have a case against them. And we are in a in a lobbying effort before Congress, because the law that enabled us to file this lawsuit is the law that Congress wanted. Congress legislated a law that gives extraterritorial jurisdiction for the United States court to put on trial those who killed American citizens abroad in terror attacks. This is what Congress wished, and the court found it unconstitutional. So now we are in issues with the Congress. We want them to solve the problem. We want to bring back the personal jurisdiction, and we are making an effort to do it. But meanwhile, I was told by the security services in Israel that the Palestinian Authority's leaders could not believe how the little support they gave the terrorists before the attack, how the money they paid them before the attack and kept paying them until now, turned in the end of the day to hundreds of millions of dollars in damages against them.
Have you ever estimated how much money has gone into Hamas, Hezbollah, the flow? And how do you, how would you do that from around the world, from either governments or donations from, you know, the own?
It's very hard, obviously. Hamas receives money in secret ways, in unknown ways. A lot of money is being smuggled in. But we know that the budget of Hamas is $500 million, and they receive it. They received it, first of all, from the Palestinian Authority itself. The Palestinian Authority is paying the salaries of the Hamas employees in Gaza. They pay the electricity bill of Hamas in Gaza. They pay for a couple of projects that Hamas is engaged with in Gaza. All it sums up to $500 million. In addition to this, Hamas obviously smuggled money in, which we don't have indication. Hezbollah budget used to be $200 million a year until recently, after Obama released $150 billion to the hands of Iran, and Iran gave some of the money to Hezbollah. So in recent years, in the past 2 years, Hezbollah's budget stands today on $1.1 billion. Believe it or not, there are surveys that are published in Forbes. When you go after the 400 Fortune organizations, businessmen, they have the most rich terror organizations. Hezbollah is in the top. Hamas is really in the middle.
You know, one of the things that really comes through in the book is the ingenuity of the Israelis and Hamas and Hezbollah in terms of how they get money, how they the spy versus spy things. And reading the book, it reminded me of, you know, that you described the way money comes in from everything from drug sales to people making donations to extortion. And I don't think Jews around the world didn't use all those techniques, but certainly the whole idea of supporting Israel, especially at the beginning. Was that ever ironic to you that these communities were sort of playing, you know, the similar, not games, but tactics?
I never thought about it. But I guess when you are engaged with illegal activity, you have to be creative how to get funded. And I would never compare the terror organizations to what the Jews tried to do prior to the states and earlier. That every activity that you try to hide, you will try to uncover its financials as well.
We'd like to remind our listening and internet audience that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Harpoon, Combating Terrorism. One of the audience questions that came in was related to the assassination of Rabin. And the idea, you look at groups, they're even within Israel, there are quote-unquote, you know, Jewish terror groups or groups for the extremely right-wing. Would you ever look at their funding, or has anyone done that?
The assassination of Rabin was not done in an organizational way. It was done by an individual. He was not supported, as far as we know, and according to his testimony in court, by no organization. It was an act that he took upon himself and decided to kill the prime minister. Your question may refer to organizations that are taking some acts sometimes against Arabs. For instance, there was a Arab kid, 15 years old, and he was burned by Jews. Again, it wasn't an organization that stood behind the attack. And when you talk about these cases, you, as I said before, you don't go after the individuals who are carrying out the attack. You go after the organization. For the reason that the individuals don't really care. You can't affect the individuals. If they don't care about human life, they won't care about assets or money. There is no way to impact them. There is a way to influence the organization that sent them. And indeed, all the laws that we are using are against the organizations who support the act of terrorism. You can go after the PLO. You can go after Hamas. You could have gone even after a terror organization which is designated as a terror organization that kill Arabs, if you would find something like this. But in Israel or the United States or anywhere in the world, there is no such a thing. If you talk about the most extreme Jewish organizations that were called like this, for instance, Kahana Chai or Kach, they were not designated as a terror organization. They were designated as extreme group. They were outlawed in Israel and in the United States under their name, but they were not terror organizations. So if you want to file a lawsuit against them, you have to prove that, first of all, they were engaged in an international act of terrorism, that they were designated as a terror organization, and they supported or were carrying out a terror attack. I'm not familiar with such cases.
We're in a situation now where Iran is obviously funding Hezbollah. You're fighting Syria, they're funding Hezbollah. There was a report today of Hezbollah members being killed in Yemen. They're in Yemen. So are the Iranians getting stretched thin? I mean, from an Israeli intelligence funding financial network, what do you see happening there?
When Meir Dagan started the fight against Iran, when he was appointed to become the head of the Mossad, he didn't want to go to, he didn't want Israel to carry out a military option. He was totally against it.
On the nuclear reactor.
Right. So the reactor. Meir Dagan was the one that hated wars. Meir Dagan did not want to risk IDF soldiers' life. This was his motto in South Lebanon when he was operating there. He lost a lot of his enemies. He killed a lot of his enemies, but lost a lot of his soldiers. And there were an incident where he really burst into tears when he heard that one of his best friends got killed in the war. When he came home, he told his wife that from now on they are going to become vegetarians because he no longer can bear carnage, flesh and blood. So he didn't want to go to war against Iran. He didn't want to take the military option. He saw it as a last resort. But how can you collapse the Iranian regime? How can you bring them to agree to any sort of agreement? By the financial warfare, by putting sanctions against them. And he was the one who came with the idea, and he convinced the colleagues in the United States to try to go after Iran. And indeed, the United States was the one who joined this financial warfare and started putting sanctions against Iran when the whole entire world refused. It took a while to convince the UN and the other nations to join these international sanctions. Whether we like the nuclear agreement that was signed in the end or not, the fact was that Iran came to negotiation just due to financial pressure. So here we are in the same situation again. Israel is back to convince United States, to convince Trump, to put back the sanctions on Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the biggest advocates for this. And United States and Trump are going into this financial war. And take a look at North Korea. The same thing. North Korea, who would even imagine that the ruler will come and agree to meet with Trump just because of the financial pressure, showing you that it really, really, really works. And if it's done by the entire world, all the nations gathered together, they can collapse the most evil regimes just by financial pressure.
Well, we'll see what happens there, and it'll be interesting in how the Chinese play it
definitely
out. Maybe geopolitics. I mean, as an Israeli, and you're in the middle of a lot, and clearly you have friends in the intelligence community and the military. What's your crystal ball show? I mean, down in Gaza on the border, there's been a tremendous amount of violence. Hezbollah is entrenched in Lebanon. It's a multi-front war in Syria. From an Israeli perspective, it's also opened up new alliances. In a way. I mean, part of what, in terms of even communications and dialogue with some of Arab countries who wouldn't acknowledge it, but they're doing things together. Do you see cooperation in ways that you haven't seen? And what do you see looking ahead?
Yes. The more severe enemy of Israel right now is Hezbollah from Lebanon. They're planning a war. Another war against Israel. They're accumulating hundreds of thousands of missiles, long-range missiles, that will hit our airport, that will hit even Be'er Sheva. And obviously, Israel is looking for allies to fight this enemy. Luckily, the Saudi Arabia is also being threatened by the same enemy, by Iran, that funds Hezbollah, that funds the Shiites in Yemen, and getting close to Saudi Arabia. We never heard Saudi Arabia being in contact with Israeli officials, and this is the new move. Israel has Egypt today as an ally as well. We, after the Muslim Brotherhood took over, King came to Sisi and threw them out. And now he's afraid of Hamas and then ISIS, fights ISIS in Sinai, and afraid of Hamas in Gaza, and became an ally in Israel. So things are definitely changing. Israel, who until now was totally isolated, suddenly found allies with Saudi Arabia, with Egypt, with Jordan, who obviously is also afraid from the Palestinians, all fighting together the Iranian regime. And all of that would not be so strong if Trump wouldn't find the Shiites as the enemies, as opposed to what his former did, finding the Shiites, trying to get closer to the Shiites.
Do you see any solution? I mean, I know you're talking about geopolitics and the pressure of the Sunni Shiite split and, you know, what's been happening there. But what could lead to a solution even in Gaza now? Is it all on Hamas to basically acknowledge Israel's right to exist and say we're no longer going to fight?
When you
and
say what, solution, you mean what?
The cessation of violence. Or do you just see this never-ending cycle?
It's a real problem. The situation in Gaza, as the situation in the West Bank. The government in Gaza totally collapsed, totally failed. The Hamas leaders cannot show their people any achievement. that they got in recent years. The situation in Gaza is catastrophic. And Hamas leaders are trying to find a solution to shift the rage of the people towards something else, not against them. So they all point them towards Israel. And they say, Israel is the problem for your the reason for your problem, the reason for your situation. And they push the people to the fence. They pay the money to go and to infiltrate into Israel. And this will continue because there is no other solution from the side of Hamas in Gaza. They will not come and settle with Israel. They will not come into agreement with Israel. And meanwhile, they have 2 million people that they control, that they have to feed, that they have to provide work with, that they have to keep them alive. It's a disaster in Gaza. So some say that the solution with the temporary solution in Gaza is really to help humanitarianly the people in Gaza. But there is an issue of how you do it. Because if you want to help people in Gaza, you either enter yourself into Gaza with danger your life, or you trust the people who control Gaza, which is Hamas. And as we saw before, if you provide the Hamas leaders with money, if you provide them with cement, if you provide them with cars, they take it to themselves. They don't give it to the population. So it's a dilemma. Now, it's not only Israel's problem. It's also the Egyptian problem because they border Hamas. And if you say, okay, Israel is the enemy of Hamas and therefore they don't want to help them, look at the Egyptians. The Egyptians are not providing Hamas with any humanitarian aid and help for exactly the same reasons. Every dollar they will bring into the Gaza Strip will be taken by Hamas leaders. So now Israel is thinking of building a port for Hamas in Cyprus. Maybe a solution, maybe not, but unfortunately, it's a real problem in Gaza. If you go to the West Bank, so their financial situation is much better. A lot of the people there come and work in Israel. They have permits. They can provide their family. It's a larger area. They are engaged with agricultural. They engage with a little bit of industry. They can support themselves a little bit. They also get money from the Israeli government with a mechanism of income tax and import tax that Israel collects and give them as a return. So their financial situation is much better than the people in Gaza. To find a solution, once again, it's... me personally, I don't think you can find a long-term solution. What we need to do is to manage the conflict. We need to make sure that the Israelis are living safely in their area, the Palestinians are living safely in their area, and there is no room for any extremism from both sides. We have a great collaboration relationship with the security services in the Palestinian Authority. And Israel and the Palestinian Authority both are working to dismantle the extreme terror organizations. This is what we need to do in the West Bank. And Gaza, the kite is just a symbol. It's from desperation. They're sending kites, flaming kites, to burn the fields in Israel. But let's not forget that this is a sort of terror attack because in the end, their wish is to hurt innocent people in the Israeli side. They paint the kites with the swastikas. They paint it with PLO flags and they're burning fields. And now they're using helium balloons with Molotov cocktails to go and burn the fields and to hurt innocent people. It's not a picnic to live in the Middle East.
No. You have six children, yes?
I do.
So do you think, after all the bloodshed on both sides and all that's happened, is that either the Israelis or the Palestinians can feel empathy for each other?
Look, we do. Of course we feel bad for the children in the West Bank and Gaza. But we also feel bad for our own children. My oldest is going to join the military. Obviously, we are afraid. All the people in Israel are afraid for their life, for their children's life, for what would happen. But I don't see, I don't think there is so much choice, because in the end, if you really, really want to be very strict and very blunt about it, it's either you care about your own children's life or their children's life. And when it comes to a dilemma, you don't have a choice. It's unfortunate. And I'm saying it because I know that the IDF is taking all steps he can in order to make sure that when he hits the enemy, it really hits the enemy and not cause a collateral damage. He's very careful about hitting civilians. The IDF sacrificed his own soldiers in ground invasion to avoid airstrikes from the air that might hit other civilians. We sacrifice our own children, our own soldiers, to make sure that there is no damage on the other side. Not necessarily in favor of this, but in the end, this is the balance. This is what has to be put on the scale. You care about your children. I care about my children. I care about my friends' children, my family's children. I do care about the other side's children as well. But this is the war. And it's not Israel who started this war. It's not Israel who sends flaming kites to burn their fields or to shoot missiles to kill their civilians or drop bombs to kill them in a massive way.
So now we have time. We're running out of time. I'm going to not give you a lot of time for this question. I should have saved up more time. But one last question. And going forward now, we talked about it briefly, social media and communications. And if you want to address that in a few minutes, in terms of dialogue and what you see as legally what you would like to see done.
Well, I think this is the next war. This is the new fight against those who provide financial service, any sort of services to designated organizations. We see that Facebook, Twitter, Google are providing a platform for the designated organizations. And these organizations are using these social media giants as a tool, an essential tool in the war. They spread their propaganda, they send their messages, they communicate with each other, they recruit militants, they raise funds on social media. And this must stop, because every terror attack starts with the social media. I can give you an example of something that happened just recently in Israel. There was a young girl. Her name was Ayehalel Yafe Ariel. She was a beautiful girl, blonde hair, blue eyes, an excellent student and a great ballet dancer. She was 13 years old. And one night they had a performance in her community, Kiryat Arba. She went to the she went and danced with her parents. She had a competition. She won. And at the end of the night, they went back home to sleep. She didn't have school the next day, so she stayed in bed when her parents left to work. And then a terrorist from the nearby village entered the community. He didn't do it through the front gate. He made a cut in the fence that alerted the security services. They came riding on their jeep looking for the one that infiltrated the community. They did not find him. He was hiding behind a bush. When they drove away, he got up. He went to the first house he saw. He tried to open the door. The door was locked, so he went through the window. He wound up in Halel's room. He was holding a knife and stabbed her 17 times in her bed until she died. Now, he was only 15 years old. And you wonder what drove him to go grab a knife and go and kill a 13 years old girl. And if you go on his Facebook page, and he had a Facebook page, you will see that he got thousands of posts, of videos, of illustrations, how to kill, incitement to kill, posts that, pages that named Stab the Jew. And before he went and stabbed, he wrote, "Death is a right. I deserve this right. It's about that we will go and do it." It's all in the social media. This incitement that used to take place in previous intifadas, in the town squares, in the mosques, today it's on Facebook, it's on Twitter, and it's Google. And therefore, if we want to stop this lone wolf attacks, this random knife stabbing attacks, we have to terminate the use that the designated organizations are doing in the social media. Once you stop that, there will be no connection anymore between those who incite to kill to those who go into it. Imagine ISIS, for instance, without YouTube. How would even people know about ISIS without these beheading videos? People from Austria or Switzerland to know to cross the border to Turkey to join ISIS in Iraq and Syria over there. So if you terminate the use that the social media are doing and giving the designated organization, you may be able to stop this random lone wolf attacks.
Okay. Our thanks to Nitzana Darshan Leitner. She's the founder and president of the Israeli Law Center and co-author of Harpoon, Hussein's Court Shirat Hadin. We also thank our audience this year, those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, today's moderator, and you've been listening to a Commonwealth Club program called Harpoon, Combating Terrorism. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.